Hi, my name is Matthias, and this is V1 & O. It's a podcast by V Magazine and powered by Yuke's, the world's leading online store for fashion, design, and art that lasts a lifetime. On this show, we're diving into the world of the stranger fixations and lesser-known interests of some of the biggest names in music and fashion by pairing them with an expert in their field of interest. On today's episode, Madison Beer. Madison is a 22-year-old singer, songwriter, and producer. She gained mainstream attention at the age of 12 when Justin Bieber tweeted out a video of Madison singing a cover of Etta James that had been posted to her YouTube channel. Seemingly overnight, Madison became a major musical powerhouse. In February of this year, Beer released her debut album, Life Support, to rave reviews, with many critics deeming it one of the best debut albums from any artist in recent years. Her 25-plus million Instagram followers tend to agree, helping singles like last year's Selfish rack up tens of millions of views on YouTube alone. On tracks like Selfish, Madison began to show a more vulnerable side of herself to the world. At the same time, she began opening up about her struggles with her mental health in an attempt to educate her fans and fight the surrounding stigma. Soon, Madison will be sharing her new songs live with her fans on a long-awaited North American and European tour. Madison wants to know about the history of psychiatry. When did society first start seriously discussing mental health, and how has the field evolved in the years since? To learn more, we spoke with Edward Shorter, a social historian, author, and professor of psychiatry at the University of Toronto, whose book, The History of Psychiatry, is often referenced as the definitive history on the subject.
Hey everyone, this is Ryan, the producer of V1 & O. One quick note about today's episode. We're going to discuss mental health. Also, as a warning, we do briefly mention suicide. When listening to this episode, it's important to remember that this is one professional's opinion. Always consult with your own mental health care professionals before making any decisions about or changes to your care. If you or someone you know is struggling, contact the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline at suicidepreventionlifeline.org or call 1-800-273-8255. Okay, now back to the show.
Here's Madison's life story in 60 seconds or less, in her own words.
Hey guys, I am Madison Beer, and I was told that I have to describe my life story in 60 seconds or less, so this is me attempting to do so. I am from Long Island, New York. I was signed and discovered when I was 12 years old on YouTube singing covers, and I am now 22 years old, been a decade in the making, and I'm a singer. I am just off of the release of my debut album, and I have another one on the way. I have a tour that tickets are on sale for right now. And if you're listening to this, I assume you have a phone. And if you want to look up more stuff about me, go ahead. Hope this was informative. And here's our podcast.
Thank you so much for doing that.
We're sorry.
I love it. No. You were the first that was like, and you can also just Google me if you want. So just to kick things off, before we get into the subject matter that we're going to get into, I wanted to ask you a little bit about Life Support. Obviously, it came out in February, so it's been a little while now, but it was supposed to come out way longer ago, even like last year.
Right.
And I guess my question is, how much had you changed in that year, and how much did the album change from what it was originally going to be?
In that year, I mean, so much changed. You know, to be honest with you, it was actually supposed to come out even before that. So a lot of the songs are pretty old at this point, but it was kind of this weird, like, juxtaposition of, like, excitement. I was really looking forward to getting the album out, but also, like, you know, I do feel like quite departed from where I'm at with a lot of the things I touch on in the album. So it's a little weird to kind of go back and, like, relive some of these emotions. I'm going on tour soon. I'm gonna have to, you know, like, bring these old feelings back up. And I think just I'm like mentally preparing for all of that, but I don't think that's a bad thing necessarily. I think that it's like a form of therapy for me, and it's extremely therapeutic to like sing and, you know, have an audience like finally being able to sing back to me and whatever. So I think I've changed a lot. I've definitely matured and grown, and specifically with the things that I talk about. And, you know, it's mainly a lot to do with a breakup. I'm at a much different place now than I was with it. And so, yeah, I would just definitely say it's weird to sing and perform an album that is kind of like you've departed a lot from how you feel about the situation.
I would assume, like, especially with something that was a bit of a breakup album, it must be a really good feeling to be like, I'm not as much in my feels about this as I was before. Like, I feel like that might also, as departed as you are, maybe that feels like a bit of a victory in yourself that it's not so.
You know, it is. It's funny that you say that. I remember I did a performance for Selfish, which like is such an emotional song for me. And I think that tour is going to feel a lot different than singing it at a studio for like a TV performance or something. But I remember that I like made a joke and I was singing it and I was so emotional. And then I was like, wow, did I do good and make everyone think that I'm still sad about my ex? And like everyone was just like, yeah, you did. And so it's interesting to kind of turn that switch back on and try to like hone into those emotions and feelings that are healed a lot since then. But then there are also days that I wake up still sad about said person or like, you know, still in my feels about certain things and feeling like I, you know, haven't gotten closure or whatever it might be that, you know, those nights that I go on stage, I think might be harder than others. But it's definitely an interesting thing to like open up a book that's you feel like you're trying so hard to close, but it just won't stop like butting its head open. And you're like, oh my God.
I mean, part of your job is like reliving that on stage every time you're like getting on stage, which is not something most of us have to do. Like if I have a breakup, I have a breakup and then I'm broken up and then I complain to my friends and then I move on. And like, nobody is telling me I need to get in front of a crowd of thousands and kind of like revisit it and then revisit it and then revisit it again.
It can be really hard. It can definitely be difficult, especially if you're just like, cause I feel like a lot of us, I can speak for most people when you break up with somebody in particular, you're just like, I just want to never think about this ever again. And especially for someone like me who like my healing processes are always pretty long and like difficult. Just sometimes I'm just like, okay, I finally feel like I'm at a good place, but now I have to like go on stage and I'll probably cry hearing all of these people sing back to me. And it's definitely weird, but I wouldn't like change it for the world. Cause like the amount of people who have come up to me and been like, you know, I got through my breakup because of Selfish or now like my new single Reckless. So many people have been, you know, messaging me and reaching out saying that it's helped them and it touches them and whatnot. And so like, I wouldn't trade it for anything, but it can be hard having to like constantly, you know, relive old feelings, but it is,
yeah,
it comes with the territory, you know,
right? And kind of reopening old wounds.
Yeah,
I was watching an old interview that you had done and you were talking about Selfish. You were saying it was really one of the first songs, if not the first song, where you felt like you were being really vulnerable, really honest, and sort of sharing that with your fans. And I wonder if when you look back on that, like at that time, were you feeling scared to be so open? Were you feeling excited that you were getting something off of your chest? Like, what was the sort of emotional attachment to finally being a little bit maybe more truthful with what you were singing about?
It was really weird and hard for me. There was many sides and layers to it. And I think particularly, like, I'm someone who I grew up with my fans. I got signed when I was 12. I've been on social media since even before then. And a lot of people who follow me, like, followed me then. And a lot of the fans who are, like, my core diehard fans, I'm close with these people. Like, I know them well. And it felt almost disingenuous to like be out there. I always say that word. I don't know if it's a real word, but I'm going to say it anyway.
I think it is. It sounds right.
It sounds right, but it feels wrong, but it's fine. I think you know what I mean. It always felt disingenuous when I would have these songs like Hurts Like Hell and Home With You and all of these, like, am I allowed to curse?
Yeah. Oh my God. You can literally do whatever you want.
Perfect. All these like bad bitch anthems, quote unquote, like, that is a part of who I am. And like, I am the girl in the room who, like, if there's like a girl at a party crying who I don't know, like, I'm the first one to go up to her and be like, you're coming with me. Do you want to have a sleepover? Who hurt you? Who are we fighting? End of discussion. So it's like, that is a huge part of who I am. But I'm also the girl who, like, will be crying at a party and I'll need someone to come up to me. And like,
yeah.
So like, I have so many sides to myself that it felt like I was only showing the one side that was the most beneficial for the narrative of like the Madison Beer brand per se. And I was like, I'm not a fucking brand. I'm a person and I have a lot to say and I have a lot of a story and I have so many emotions. And this was before I ever really like opened up. I've always touched on my mental health lightly because, again, like, my fans and I are so close that like within live streams or whatnot, I've like broken down and spoken to them. But I think Selfish was a really big turning point because sonically I had never dipped my toes into anything emotionally charged or real, because I'm like conditioned at this point to being canceled, I would say, for lack of better words. Like, I you know, get canceled every 6 months on social media, which then has led me to have horrible PTSD, which has then led me to not want to even ever open my mouth, especially about things that are so personal and emotional for me. It can be really scary to have things like that put up for interpretation, have people like make their own assumptions, form their own opinions. It's a lot. And so it was a battle within myself to decide, okay, are we doing this? Are we not doing it? And I decided, let's just do it. You owe your fans this narrative and this perspective, and you can't have a song like Home With You, for, let's give an example. I remember when that song was on radio and I was super proud of it, of course. I had a lot of people coming up to me and they'd be like, oh my God, I love your song Home With You, whatever. And they would be like, it makes me feel like such a bad bitch. I feel so confident, da, 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 da. But then I would be like, yeah, that's amazing. But like, I'm going through a breakup right now and like, I cry myself to sleep every night and like, I don't feel like a bad bitch. And so I felt like it was just this like weird kind of like, oh, I'm so glad like you're taking the advice I'm giving you and I'm not type of thing.
Right.
So I just was like, I need to just show them this other side. That's why I like also the music video. It's so stripped back. I have like no makeup on. It's very like natural. I wanted these like up close shots of my face and like crying and whatever. And yeah, I just really felt that it was time in my career and like in my life to just be honest with people. And I'm just so happy that I did, because it's my most successful song to date. And Reckless is now following in its footsteps. And I think that just shows that like, people want transparency and that it goes a long way. And I'm going to continue to tell my story whenever I can, and, you know, at my own pace as well. And when I feel it's right.
I think it's like one of the most beautiful things when an artist kind of breaks through of like, this is who I really am. Like I'm now kind of at a point in my career where I feel like comfortable putting it out, or I have to put it out, or, you know, like whatever it is.
Right.
And the fans and the world are like incredibly receptive. Everybody was so receptive to Selfish, and I can imagine how scary it would have been to put out. And then it's like, you put out something that is really vulnerable, that is a little bit not like a bad bitch anthem, like you said, and people loved it. And I feel like there's a lot to sort of learn from that. Like when we're kids, we all learn like, be who you are, and it's such a cliche, and we think we know like what that means, and we're like, yeah, I get it, we're all unique, I should be myself. And then you actually do something like this and you're like, oh shit, like be who you are, like that actually, you kind of get it in a very adult way all of a sudden.
Yeah, I think that's 100% accurate. And I think that I was just like taught, you know, like that's part of like your brand, and this is like who you are, is this like, you know, role model for young girls to be confident and whatever. And like, I would feed into that, but then I would like literally cry myself to sleep and be like going through terrible things. And I just was like, this isn't authentic. And it just didn't feel real. It felt like I was giving people like a fraction of who I truly was. And I'm really, really glad that people took a liking to it and actually like wanted to hear that side from me. It meant a lot. And it only now has like encouraged me to continue to make music like that.
I want to ask you, just before we kind of get more into like the mental health stuff, you speak in like such a lovely way about your fans, and in a way where, you know, you can tell you actually feel so close with these people. And there was another interview I was reading that, you know, they were talking about, you kind of had envisioned this album release party that was, you know, this huge party. And then in the end, it was kind of you and your team and your two friends, and you were joking like, well, you know, because I have two friends. And I was just thinking about this dichotomy of, I would assume that you do sort of have this in IRL, really close-knit, small social circle. And then you have the fans, which, you know, are in the millions. And it's like a really strange dichotomy, right? Like you only have a couple people that are close to you, but then you also have millions of people that are close to you and you feel really close to them. And I'm like, I can't really wrap my head around that.
Yeah, no, 100%. I think, first of all, I'm so bummed that I didn't get to do that. I was like looking forward to having a little like slumber party, release party with my fans. So I'm still bummed that that didn't happen. Hopefully for album two, I can make something like that happen though. But yeah, it is interesting. I'm pretty like closed off to the real world. I mean, and the online world, to be frank. I try not to like go on social media too much. It's a lot for me a lot of the times. But yeah, there's so many people out there who I feel like I have such a real genuine connection with. And then in real life, yeah, I have that, but it's no more than like 10 people that I feel like I can trust and that I'm close with and that I can like rely on. It can be really hard.
It's perfectly fair though. Like I can't wrap my head around it, but I understand why it is the way it is. You know,
yeah,
there's not a lot of people that can relate to it basically.
Yeah, no, I wouldn't have it any other way. I'm so grateful for the tribe I've created around me, and I have such amazing people that like I would trust with my life. And for a long time I, you know, had the idea like more the merrier, and I want to be super popular and have so many friends. And as you get older, you kind of realize like, you know, I'd definitely rather have four quarters than 100 pennies. And like, I I just value like real people and real connection and friendships a lot more than, you know, like the nonsense that goes on.
Yeah, I've never heard that saying before. It's so good.
Really?
Four quarters rather than... Yeah, am I like an idiot? I've never heard that before.
I was like, did I say that even correct? I'm really bad at math, so I don't know. But yeah.
I'm going to put it up on quotes websites as if you invented it. By Madison Beer. So just before Edward comes on, I just wanted to ask you why mental health and sort of like the history of mental health is something that you want to learn more about, something that you actively discuss. Why was that the topic you wanted to hone in on?
There's a million reasons why, but I think that mainly, you know, I struggled in silence for so long and I felt like I was so alone, and there's such a stigma around mental health that going through it made me really realize it. Because, you know, when I would tell my friends, oh, I'm going to, you know, I can't meet you at lunch, I have a therapist appointment, I would get looks that were much different than I would get if I was like, oh, I have to go get my nails done. And so things like that made me realize that there's just this stigma around it that's so, it just perpetuates like all the wrong things, and it makes people not want to open up and talk about it. And, you know, you tell people, oh, I have like crippling anxiety and da 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 da, and they're like, okay, like, you know, woe is me. And it's just, there's just so much stigma around it. And I think that it wasn't something that I was necessarily raised being aware of. And I think that like even more so someone like my mom and like in, you know, the older age demographics, like they weren't raised with even the terminology anxiety. Like they weren't taught what that was, I feel like, at all. So for me, I think it's just important because I have a very pessimistic outlook on social media, I guess. And I feel like whenever I talk about it, people are like, damn girl, for someone who has so many followers, you seem like you hate social media. And it's not really about that. I just am also aware of the harmful effects that I think it's having on, like, you know, young people and children. And I'm just hoping that the more we can talk about mental health, the more aware we can make our kids and hopefully prevent a lot of bad things from happening in the future. And yeah, I'm just passionate about it because I wish that there was someone who spoke candidly about it when I was 12 on Instagram and I was, you know, doing all the things that 12-year-olds do on social media. I just think that it hopefully will help something someday, somehow, you know?
Yeah, no, it's a great answer. And I feel like even for people that maybe they don't feel the sort of stigma to it, but still don't necessarily understand it because they don't experience it. Like, I also have horrible anxiety sometimes. And sometimes when I express that with people, they'll be like, yeah, like I get really stressed out too, you know? And it's like, I'm not mad at you because you're trying to understand it, but you actually still don't understand it. So I feel like even for people where, again, it's not a stigmatized thing, there's a lot to be learned. So it's still really helpful, I believe, to talk about it.
I mean, you know, many people get misdiagnosed a day with different things. It's just like, we have a lot to learn. We have a lot to talk about. And I think that it's hopefully going in a better direction. I think that, you know, kids are becoming much more aware of these terms and how to identify them earlier and whatnot. And I am hoping that it can be put into practice, because I think there's a lot of harmful aspects of social media and that it rots your brain in a lot of ways. So
for sure, no question. Again, I was really happy it was a subject you wanted to do, and just in researching, I mean, I haven't met you, but I was seeing you talk about it and I was like, I'm really proud of this person for discussing it in the way that they are, because that is not easy to do. It's really not easy to do, especially when you know that there's millions of people listening. So Ryan, who's our lovely producer, if you want to bring in, his name is Edward, he'll tell us a little bit about himself. Again, you can kind of dive in, and I'll also be asking questions, like it's just meant to be a conversation. Hello, Edward.
Hi, Matthias, how are you?
I'm good, how are you?
I'm okay.
Thank you so much for joining us here. So we have the lovely Madison Beer.
Hi.
Hi, Madison. How are you?
How are you? Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you, too.
Edward, just to start off, I'm wondering if you can tell us a little bit about yourself and your work, and you know the subject that we're going to get into, so maybe a little bit about your experience in psychiatry and the history of psychiatry and what we're going to be discussing.
Sure. I am at the University of Toronto in the Faculty of Medicine, And I have the history of medicine chair, and I have a particular interest in the history of psychiatry and psychopharmacology. And I also have the academic rank of professor of psychiatry. So I have been in the middle of the psychiatry world for many years, and I've written quite a bit about it. I wrote what is actually the standard history of psychiatry that appeared in 1995 and has been translated into many languages and is used all over the world. Is that enough, or do you want to hear something more, Matthias?
No, that's enough. You sound like a pretty smart guy, I have to say.
Probably.
Okay. No, that's great. So basically, Madison's going to be asking you a couple questions. I might jump in and ask a couple questions too. And that's sort of the name of the game. It's pretty straightforward. Madison, right. Is there anything that you want to start off with?
I guess we can just start off talking, like, when do you think that people first started discussing mental health?
Well, there's always been psychiatric illness. We refer to it today as mental health because we don't like the ring of psychiatric illness. But these are real illnesses, just like cardiac illness and kidney illnesses are real illnesses. And they deserve the distinction of being real diseases. They aren't just something that's made up by a bunch of unhappy people who have nothing to do. And so the psychiatry as a field begins late in the 18th century, late in the 1700s, with the establishment of the first asylums. Now, there have always been mental illnesses and physicians who were able to treat mental illnesses, but they didn't call themselves psychiatrists, or they didn't think of themselves as doing psychiatry in particular. That was just part of medicine. What gives psychiatry its impetus to take off as a field, because it was late in the 18th century that the first asylums or the first mental hospitals were laid down. And it takes a lot of administrative skill to run one of these. And so that was what caused the field to emerge as a definite field of medicine. It's one of the earliest medical specialties. And they didn't have anything to offer in the way of therapeutics, except confinement, institutionalizing people in and of itself was thought to be therapeutic. They certainly didn't have any idea about the causes of mental illness, but that was the beginning of the field. And then the field moves forward in time. First, it's based on madness, people who are psychotic, right? Madness. And that was what it would take to get you admitted to an asylum, that you would have delusions or hallucinations. Those are the definitions of madness.
Right.
And then in the course of the 19th century, psychiatry started to discover mood disorders, that psychiatry is something more than just madness. There were also disorders of mood. And of course, mood disorders predominate in psychiatry today because mood is such an essential part of our lives, whether we are up or whether we're down, and there's certainly pathological variations on mood. And at the same time, with the advent of psychotherapy, psychiatry started to move out of the asylum and into Main Street. So the typical psychiatrist would be somebody who practiced alone rather than who was part of a big mental hospital team. Practice alone, doing psychotherapy mainly, because before the Second World War, they didn't have much to offer in terms of medications. And then, like the clock ticking, everything changes after the Second World War with the introduction of effective medications. And now I'm sure you won't have heard of this, and stop me if this starts to get boring.
I'm so interested.
No, you're good. This is completely new to me, at least.
All right, okay. So in 1952, the first drug against psychosis is introduced. And up until that time, there were sedatives. If people were agitated, we could sedate them with sedatives. But people who were psychotic, who had delusions and hallucinations, we had nothing to offer them. And then in 1952, chlorpromazine, which is the generic term of the drug, is introduced, and it was marketed in the United States as Thorazine. Thorazine probably won't ring a bell for anybody. And that really did change things, because all of a sudden, we're able to treat patients who are in asylums. They're in asylums because they're delusional or because they have hallucinations. And chlorpromazine doesn't cure schizophrenia, but it makes it manageable. So you put people on a chlorpromazine, they can be discharged from these big mental hospitals. And that was a kind of double-edged sword because, hey, it's wonderful that they're able to be discharged and to go out to the community again. But then, hey, it's not so wonderful what happens to them once they're in the community. There was supposed to be a big network of mental health centers and so forth to look after these people, but that never materialized. And right. So this is the beginning of the street people, the patients with major mental illnesses who don't take their drugs because the drugs have side effects they don't like, but they remain ill. And so they're victimized in the streets. In any event, this side of the story has not been a triumph for psychiatry. Then psychiatry moves forward then with this major new tool. And the new tool was psychopharmacology, the ability to treat patients with drugs. And today psychiatry is axed on psychopharmacology. Psychiatrists have gone from being the least prescribing medical specialty in the world to the most prescribing. There is no medical specialty that prescribes more medications today than psychiatry. And this again has been a double-edged sword. Yep. This is almost a travesty of the way psychiatry is supposed to work. It's precisely the way psychiatry is not supposed to work, for the doctor-patient relationship in and of itself. It's therapeutic. But that's where we are today. The field is, the mental hospitals have been abolished. Psychiatry is overwhelmingly based in private practice or in hospital teams, and it's organized around the prescription of medication. Psychotherapy now has been turfed to psychiatric social workers or to psychologists. Psychiatrists don't really do it anymore. And a lot of people are unhappy with this system, unhappy with what it's become. So that, in a nutshell, Madison, is how the field has changed. Yeah. Now, I realize this has been a huge overview. What specific questions are there in your mind you want to hear about?
Well, I think that it's interesting what you said. It's mind-blowing to me how, you know, these studies started as soon as the 1800s, if not sooner. And it's like, still to this day, there's so much stigma around mental health. And like you said at the start, that, you know, it should be taken just as seriously as a cardiac issue, but it's not. It's still to this day, you can't call into work and say, hey, I'm having an anxiety attack, I can't make it in. Mm-hmm. But if you were to say, I have a cold, they would tell you to take the day off. And I think that it's really interesting, because a lot of, to me, what I find as a huge flaw, and I think this field to this day, is that, like, if something isn't physical and you can't see it, a lot of people think, like you said, it's just unhappy people making excuses, being exaggerative, whatever it might be, when in reality, these are people with, you know, crippling things that are just to be taken just as seriously as something that you can do an MRI scan and find.
Oh, that's right. And there are really two kinds of illnesses. One, there are the brain illnesses. The major illnesses in psychiatry are brain illnesses, like melancholic depression, schizophrenia, catatonia. There is something wrong with your brain.
There's a chemical, and the good news is that, whatnot,
the good news is that these are readily treatable. And then the other kinds of illnesses, that's the big P psychiatry. Small P psychiatry are things that, well, the role of the brain isn't entirely clear. Anxiety disorders, you mentioned just a moment ago, a lot of what is called depression, obsessive compulsive behavior, phobias, that kind of thing, where it's not clear that there's a brain lesion, and yet people are clearly ill, and they can be helped with meds, and they can be helped with psychotherapy. And these are the illnesses that are really stigmatized, because they have this air about them of unreality. You talked about anxiety a moment ago. I can't come into work because I'm having an anxiety attack. Well, everybody's anxious. What are you talking about? Come into work anyway. So there's a complete incomprehension when it comes to anxiety. If you say I have pathological anxiety, well, hey, that's very real.
100%.
But it's stigmatized.
Yeah, very much so. I think that for me particularly, like, I've, you know, opened up only recently about a lot of the things I've struggled with, and I've tried to, you know, I'm still learning, obviously. This is a very new field for me. I've always felt these feelings, but now finally having the terminology and being able to, you know, use words I never even knew existed prior to this, it's been really nice. I feel like I'm trying as best as I can to spread the message that, you know, these things are very real and they should be taken seriously. And if I could make a dream world, I would have, you know, like how there's sexual education in schools, there should be mental health education, and there should be ways that we can integrate that and teach our kids from a really early age signs of anxiety, depression, how to combat them, coping mechanisms you can instill into your everyday life that might not make things go away, but they can make them manageable and livable.
A lot of these illnesses are incurable in the sense that they won't go away. They can be managed. Yeah. You can be relieved of your symptoms, even if there's a chance that you will relapse again.
Exactly.
But since you were talking about yourself as a young woman, it's interesting to note that psychiatry has a long history of being unable to deal with the symptoms of young women in particular. Psychiatry used to be, and still is in part, really run by middle-aged men.
Right.
Middle-aged men have a problem empathizing with the issues of young women. They just don't understand them. They don't understand young women at all, what makes them tick. And so when psychiatrists encounter something they don't understand, they are inclined to give it a diagnosis, to pathologize it. And so over the years, young women had lots of different diagnoses that nobody else had gotten except young women.
Right.
This started back in the 18th century, back in the 1700s, with chlorosis. Chlorosis really meant that you were sort of pale and anemic, but that wasn't the center of it. The center of it was that you had the issues that were troubling you that nobody could understand. So chlorotic women were dismissed as sort of being marginal, beyond the pale. And then once iron deficiency anemia was discovered, we'll give these pale young women iron pills, and this will make the anemia better. And so the diagnosis of chlorosis went away and was replaced by hysteria. I'm sure you've heard of hysteria.
Yes.
It's not a diagnosis that's used anymore, but it was used extensively in the 19th and early 20th century. And hysteria is one of these terms that could mean just about anything.
Right.
It could mean psychosomatic symptoms. You've got stomach pain that nobody can diagnose. Well, the pain is hysterical. Or you are emotionally incontinent. You get all excited about things or tend to react in a very emotional way that other people would treat in a kind of normal way. Well, you're hysterical. Or you have these funny paralyses that come and go. Well, in the 19th century, these are common. They were called hysteria. Then the whole hysteria story moves forward on two tracks. One of the tracks is psychoanalysis. Now, do you know, Madison, what is meant by the term psychoanalysis?
When they analyze your brain?
More specific than that. Psychoanalysis is Freud's ideas. Freud conceived of psychoanalysis as a specific mode of diagnosing and treating mental illnesses. And so it's Freud who puts the concept of mental illness center stage, because he didn't believe the brain was involved at all. If you think the brain is heavily involved, you don't use a term like mental illness, because that means the mind. But hysteria was a big diagnosis for Freud, and he thought it was the result of sexual repression. Again, this is a diagnosis for young women. If you as a young woman are sexually repressed, then you are going to develop symptoms to compensate for that repression, like conversion symptoms, like all of a sudden you go blind or you can't move your arm or whatever. So that was a psychoanalytic point of view. Said, well, we got to give you psychotherapy here, which we'll call psychoanalysis. And that will try to get it, your unconscious mind, to get it conflicts within your unconscious mind. In Freud's day, there were a lot of young women who were sexually repressed because they were held close to their families. So this was one track that hysteria moved forward on. The other track was a sort of brain disease track. Neurologists in particular like to be able to find lesions. And if they can't find a lesion, they say, well, the symptoms are hysterical. And they still do that today. So hysteria was used in medicine as a synonym for we can't find a lesion. It was used in psychoanalysis as a synonym for you're sexually repressed.
Do you mind just explaining like what a lesion is, like what these people were looking for? I don't know if everyone will be familiar with that.
Sure. A lesion would be some brain disorder, a disorder of neurochemistry, such as you don't have enough serotonin or some set of cerebral circuits that means that you are chronically melancholic or that you have catatonia. So those are lesions. It means that you've got a specific problem in your brain, an organic problem. And that is probably the origin of the serious psychiatric illnesses I've mentioned now, the really serious ones. With the small piece of psychiatry, it's not at all clear that there's anything wrong with your brain. For example, if you go off in combat, if you're deployed to Afghanistan and you come home and kill your wife, okay, this would be PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. There's nothing wrong with your brain. You came back from Afghanistan full of stress. This is a way of dealing with that stress. By running off the rails anxiety, for example, is highly stress related. There's not necessarily any underlying lesion in anxiety as there is in melancholic depression, but it's very real nonetheless, even though you can't point to a CAT scan and say, hey, there it is, the anxiety center, right where we thought it would be. That doesn't exist. Does that answer your question, Matthias?
It does. I'm curious, Edward, if you can speak a little bit about any of the sort of overarching current trends you're seeing in mental health in terms of stigma or just sort of more awareness. Like, what have the recent changes in the last decade maybe been?
Several trends. One of the trends is that psychiatrists are really getting out of the business of patient care. In hospital psychiatry, the psychiatrist is responsible for the diagnosis and figuring out the therapeutic regimen. Then the actual looking after the patient is done by psychiatric nurses, psychiatric social workers, and so forth. So psychiatrists now really are not delivering psychotherapy at all. Second important trend is that psychiatry has really run out of medications. There have been no new medications in psychiatry for the last 40 years.
Oh, wow.
And the therapeutic mainstays are still Prozac and its cousins. Prozac was introduced in 1988, and it's been long off patent. The other so-called SSRIs, the Prozac and its cousins, are all off patent too. There haven't been any new superior drugs to replace these. These are not very good drugs. And yet it's all that psychiatrists have in their armamentarium, unless you're psychotic. So this is also a trend. There's a desperate search now within psychopharmacology to find medications that work for the kinds of illnesses that people have, because Prozac really doesn't work very well.
Yeah, I've been on a few antidepressants, and it's like one side effect is with one other one, and it takes one problem away but adds another, and it just feels like it's, for me personally, I really didn't like being on, I was on Prozac, I was on Lexapro, I've gone through the cycle of medications, I even was prescribed Seroquel at one point, which is an antipsychotic medication, like I've been on a few things, and it's just tough. I feel like that's another thing that I would love to know, like, lastly, your opinion on that, and like what you would advise someone like me in my position who is still kind of trying to find the right medication that would work for me, because I do all I can on a regular day-to-day basis where, you know, I try to self-soothe, and I'll do things like take a bath that for 20 minutes will make me feel better, but I could have, you know, an episode and be spiraling that night and end up in a really bad, dangerous place, and I'm still trying to treat that to this day and like find a way to keep myself balanced. And I think I've done a good job on my own and with therapy, but it's tough. So do you think that medication is a good answer? Do you think it's a bad answer? Is there no real right or wrong? It's just per patient or per person. And what would you say is the best approach to something like that?
Yeah, okay, that's a good question. There are not a lot of effective medications in psychiatry. The Prozac and its cousins, Zoloft and Paxil and so forth, are just not very good drugs, and they don't work for a lot of people. In the history of psychiatry, there are more effective drugs for depression, the so-called tricyclic antidepressants, the TCAs, that do work for serious depression, but they have quite a few side effects. But hey, if the alternative is a bit of dry mouth, suicide, then you're going to go for
that. I'll take the dry mouth.
Even though they do have more side effects than Prozac does.
Yeah, I mean, I'm honestly open to looking into anything. I think that, I was diagnosed with borderline personality disorder, which I've had a handful of psychiatrists and therapists and whatnot tell me that it's just an uncurable thing and that it's something you have just learned to live with. I think that makes me feel better to hear that there is some sort of help out there.
I think we have to kind of call it a day on that, but I wanted to thank both of you so much for being a part of this. It was super interesting. Madison, thank you so much. Edward, thank you for being so enlightening. I had no idea about anything you just said, and I need to Google so many terms so I can try to understand it.
Yeah, thank you. Okay. It was super informative and really interesting.
A pleasure talking with both of you.
Thank you so, so much.
You can find a comprehensive list of all of Edward's publications on his website, edwardshorterauthor.com. His forthcoming book, The Rise and Fall of the Age of Pharmacology, is available for pre-order now. As we mentioned in the beginning of the show, Madison Beer's album Life Support is available for streaming, and you can catch her on her tour in both North America and Europe later this year. Dates are available on madisonbeer.com. V1NO is produced by Ryan Killian Kraus. I'm your host, Matthias. We'll see you next time.